of July 24th, 1943, a hot summer Saturday in Hamburg under clear skies. Pathfinder bombers used radar to aid marking, and the initial Hamburg aiming point was chosen not for its strategic significance, but for its distinctive radar reflection, a triangle of land at the junction of the Alster and North Elbe rivers, near the oldest part of the city, and far from any war industry. Bomber Command had learned to adjust targeting for creep back, the tendency of bombardiers to release their bombs as quickly as possible upon approaching the flak-infested aiming point, that led to a gradual backup of impacts. From the ground, the bombs seemed to unroll in the direction of the bomber stream's approach. Survivors named the phenomenon carpet bombing. Targeters incorporated creep back into their calculations by setting the aiming point several miles forward of the intended target area. The creep-back districts behind the Hamburg aiming point, to a distance of 4 miles, were entirely residential. To give the bombers further advantage, Churchill had authorized the first use of the secret radar-jamming device known as Window. Bales of 10.5-inch strips of aluminum foil to be pushed out of the bombers en route to the target to disperse on the wind and cloud German defensive radar. Window worked so well that of the 791 planes of the initial raid, only 12 were lost. Hamburg sustained heavy damage that first night, but not damage even on the scale of Cologne. 1,300 tons of high explosives and almost 1,000 tons of incendiaries killed about 1,500 people and left many thousands homeless. More important for what would follow, the first raid seriously disrupted communications and overwhelmed firefighting forces. Daylight precision bombing by American B-17s followed on July 25th and 26th. Attacks meant for a submarine yard and an aircraft engine factory. Smoke from the British bombing and from German defensive generators obscured the targets, and they were only lightly damaged. Harris ordered a maximum bombing effort against Hamburg again for the night of July 27th. Targeters fixed the same aiming point, but aligned the bomber stream to approach from the northeast rather than the north, to set its creep back over districts dense with workers' apartment buildings. Since the mix of 787 bombers for this second raid would include more Halifaxes and Stirlings, and they could carry less weight of weapons and fuel than the longer-distance Lancasters, the mix of bombs was also changed, high explosives reduced, and incendiaries increased to more than 1,200 tons. More experienced pilots also came aboard, higher-ranking officers signing on to observe the effects of Window. These accidents of arrangement contributed their share to the night's catastrophe. At 6 p.m. in Hamburg on July 27th, the temperature was 86 degrees and the humidity 30%. Fires still burned in stores of coal and coke in the western sector of the city. Since the fires would render a blackout ineffective, most of Hamburg's firefighting equipment had been moved to the area to douse them. "It was completely quiet," recalls a German woman who lived in a district targeted for creepback, miles to the northeast. "It was an enchantingly beautiful summer night." Pathfinders started dropping yellow markers and bombs at 55 minutes past midnight on July 28th. 5 minutes later, the main bomber stream arrived. Marking was good, and creepback was slow. Later arrivals began to notice a difference between this raid and the others they had flown. "Most of the raids we did looked like gigantic firework displays over the target area," a flight sergeant remarks. "But this was the daddy of them all." A flight lieutenant distinguishes the difference. "The burning of Hamburg that night was remarkable in that I saw not many fires, but one. Set in the darkness was a turbulent dome of bright red fire, lighted and ignited like the glowing heart of a vast brazier. I saw no flames, no outlines of buildings, only brighter fires which flared like yellow torches against a background of bright red ash. Above the city was a misty red haze. I looked down, fascinated, but aghast, satisfied, yet horrified. I had never seen a fire like that before, and was never to see its like again. The summer heat and low humidity, the mix of high explosive and incendiary bombs that made kindling and then ignited it, and the absence of firefighting equipment in the bomb districts, conspired to assemble a new horror. An hour after the bombing began, the horror had a name, recorded first in the main log of the Hamburg Fire Department. Führersturm, firestorm. A Hamburg factory worker remembers its beginning some 20 minutes into the one-hour bombing raid. Then a storm started, a shrill howling in the street. It grew into a hurricane, so that we had to abandon all hope of fighting the factory fire. It was as though we were doing no more than throwing a drop of water onto a hot stone. The whole yard, the canal, in fact, as far as we could see, was just a whole, great, massive sea of fire. Small fires had coalesced into larger fires, and greedy for oxygen had sucked air from around the coalescing inferno and fanned further fires there. That created the wind, a thermal column above the city like an invisible chimney above a hearth. The wind heated the fury at the center of the firestorm to more than 1,400 degrees, heat sufficient to melt the windows of a streetcar, wind sufficient to uproot trees. A 15-year-old Hamburg girl recalls, "Mother wrapped me in wet sheets, kissed me, and said, 'Run!' I hesitated at the door. In front of me, I could see only fire, everything red, like the door to a furnace. An intense heat struck me. A burning beam fell in front of my feet. I shied back, but then, when I was ready to jump over it, it was whirled away by a ghostly hand. I ran out into the street. The sheets around me acted as sails, and I had the feeling that I was being carried away by the storm. I reached a 5-story building in front of which we had arranged to meet again. Someone came out, grabbed me by the arm, and pulled me into the doorway." The fire filled the air with burning embers and melted the streets, a 19-year-old milliner reports. "We came to the door, which was burning just like a ring in a circus through which a lion has to jump. The rain of large sparks blowing down the street were each as large as a 5-mark piece. I struggled to run against the wind in the middle of the street, but could only reach a house on the corner. We got to the Loschplatz Park all right, but I couldn't go on across the Effestrasse because the asphalt had melted. There were people on the roadway, some already dead, some still lying alive but stuck in the asphalt. They must have rushed onto the roadway without thinking. Their feet had got stuck, and then they had to put out their hands to try to get out again. They were on their hands and knees, screaming." The firestorm completely burned out some 8 square miles of the city, an area about half as large as Manhattan. The bodies of the dead cooked in pools of their own melted fat in sealed shelters, like kilns, or shriveled to small blackened bundles that littered the streets. Or worse, as the woman who was once the 15-year-old girl horribly recreates, 4-story-high blocks of flats the next day were like glowing mounds of stone, right down to the basement. Everything seemed to have melted and pressed the bodies away in front of it. Women and children were so charred as to be unrecognizable. Those that had died through lack of oxygen were half-charred and recognizable. Their brains had tumbled from their burst temples and their insides from the soft parts under the ribs. How terribly, these people must have died. The smallest children lay like fried eels on the pavement. Bomber Command killed at least 45,000 Germans that night, the majority of them old people, women, and children. The bombing of Hamburg was hardly unique. It was one atrocity in a war of increasing atrocities. Between 1941 and 1943, the German army on the Eastern Front, captured and enclosed in prisoner of war camps without food or shelter, some 2 million Soviet soldiers. At least 1 million of them died of exposure and starvation. During the same period, the final solution to the Jewish question, the vast Nazi program to exterminate the European Jews, began in deadly earnest after the Wannsee Conference of Coordinating Agencies met in suburban Berlin on January 20, 1942. Whatever moral issues such atrocities raise, they resulted from the progressive escalation of the war by all its belligerents in pursuit of victory. Even the final solution, because the Nazis believed the Jews constituted a separate nation lodged subversively in their midst, nationality being defined in the Nazi canon primarily in terms of race, and as such, the nation with which the Third Reich was preeminently at war. It was Hitler's particular perversity to define victory over the Jews as extermination. The Allies, in their defensive war against Germany and Japan, wanted only total surrender, in return for which the mass killing of combatants and civilians would stop. One way the belligerents could escalate was to improve their death technologies. Better bombers and better bomber defenses, such as Window, were hardware improvements. So were the showers at the death camps, efficiently pumped with the deadly fumigant Zyklon B. The bomber stream system and allowance for creep back were software improvements. So were the schedules of Adolf Eichmann devised that kept the trains running efficiently to the camps. The other way the belligerents could escalate was to enlarge the range of permissible victims their death technologies might destroy. Civilians had the misfortune to be the only victims left available. Better hardware and software began to make them also accessible in increasing numbers. No great philosophical effort was required to discover acceptable rationales. War begot psychic numbing in combatants and civilians alike. Psychic numbing prepared the way for increasing escalation. Extend war by attrition to include civilians behind the lines, and war becomes total. With improving technology, so could death-making be. The bombing of Hamburg marked a significant step in the evolution of death technology itself. Massed bombers deliberately churning conflagration. It was still too much a matter of luck, an elusive combination of weather and organization and hardware. It was still also expensive in crews and materiel. It was not yet perfect, as no technology can ever be, and therefore seemed to want perfecting. The British and the Americans would be enraged to learn of Japanese brutality and Nazi torture, of the Bataan Death March, and the fathomless horror of the death camps. By a reflex so mindlessly unimaginative it may be merely mammalian, the bombing of distant cities, out of sight and sound and smell, was generally approved, although neither the United States nor Great Britain admitted publicly that it deliberately bombed civilians. In Churchill's phrase, the enemy was to be dehoused. The Jap and the Nazi, in any case, had started the war. We must face the fact that modern warfare, as conducted in the Nazi manner, is a dirty business, Franklin Roosevelt told his countrymen. We don't like it. We didn't want to get in it. But we are in it, and we're going to fight it with everything we've got. The Los Alamos Review Committee, headed by W.K. Lewis of MIT, reported its findings on May 10, 1943. It approved the laboratory's nuclear physics research program. It recommended that theoretical investigation of the thermonuclear bomb continue at second priority, subordinate to fission bomb work. It proposed a major change in the chemistry program, final purification of plutonium on the Hill, because Los Alamos would be ultimately responsible for the performance of the plutonium bomb, and because the scarce new element would be used and reused for experiments during the months before a sufficient quantity accumulated to load a bomb, and would have to be frequently repurified. The Lewis Committee also concurred in a recommendation Robert Oppenheimer had made in March that ordnance development and engineering should begin immediately at Los Alamos, rather than wait until nuclear physics studies were complete. General Groves accepted the committee's findings. They dictated an immediate doubling of Hill personnel. Thereafter, until the end of the war, the Los Alamos working population would double every 9 months. The dust of construction never settled. Housing would always be short, water scarce, electricity intermittent. Groves spent not a penny more than necessary on comforts for civilians. The bottom pole piece of the Harvard cyclotron had been laid on April 14th. By the first week in June, Robert Wilson's cyclotron group saw signs of a beam. The Wisconsin long tank Van de Graaff came online at 4 million volts on May 15th, and the 2 MV short tank Van de Graaff on June 10th. In July, the first physics experiment completed at Los Alamos counted the number of secondary neutrons Pu-239 emitted when it fissioned. In this experiment, says the Los Alamos Technical History, the neutron number was measured from an almost invisible speck of plutonium and found to be somewhat greater even than for U-235. The experiment thus established what had not yet been confirmed despite the expensive rush of building, that plutonium emitted sufficient secondary neutrons to chain react. The speck of plutonium was Glenn Seaborg's 200 milligram sample of MetLab oxide, which he had sent to Los Alamos at the beginning of the month. Seaborg had worked himself sick at the MetLab that spring, an upper respiratory infection compounded with exhaustion and a persistent fever, and came to New Mexico with his wife during July to vacation. "I guess I deliberately chose to be near the plutonium," he muses. "I wonder why." Too much peace and quiet at a guest ranch threatened to exhaust him further, and on July 21st, he and his wife moved to the adobe-style La Fonda Hotel in Santa Fe. Compartmentalization put Los Alamos off limits. The Seaborgs were ready to return to Chicago on Friday, July 30th, and Seaborg proposed to carry the PU sample, most of the world's supply, back with him on the train. Robert Wilson and another physicist made the transfer before dawn in the restaurant where the Seaborgs were having breakfast in Santa Fe, Wilson arriving in a pickup armed Western style with his personal Winchester 32 deer hunting rifle to guard a highly valuable but barely visible treasure. "Then I just put it in my pocket and then into my suitcase," Seaborg remembers. He proceeded to Chicago unarmed. To direct the expanded Ordnance Division, Groves asked the Military Policy Committee in Washington to recommend a good man, preferably a military officer. Vannevar Bush knew a naval officer. Would Groves mind? "Of course not," the general humphed. Bush proposed Captain William S. Deke Parsons, a 1922 Annapolis graduate then responsible under Bush for field testing the proximity fuse. Parsons had also worked on early radar development and served as gunnery officer on a destroyer and experimental officer at the Naval Proving Ground in Dahlgren, Virginia. He was 43, cool, vigorous, trim, nearly bald, spit and polish, but innovative. All his life, one of the men who worked for him at Los Alamos testifies in praise, he fought the silly regulations and the conservatism of the Navy. Groves liked him. "Within a few minutes of meeting him," the general says, "I was sure he was the man for the job." Oppenheimer interviewed the man for the job in Washington and agreed. Parsons was married to a Martha Cluverius, a Vassar graduate and the daughter of an admiral. With two blonde daughters and a cocker spaniel, the couple arrived at Los Alamos in an open red convertible in June. Parsons' first order of business was the plutonium gun. Because it needed a muzzle velocity of at least 3,000 feet per second, it would have to be 17 feet long. It should weigh no more than a ton, a fifth of the usual weight of a gun that size, which meant it would have to be machined from strong, high-alloy steel. It would not require rifling, but needed three independently operated primers to make sure it fired. Parsons arranged for the Navy's gun design section to engineer it. Norman F. Ramsey, a tall young Columbia physicist, the son of a general, served under Parsons as group leader for delivery, for devising a way to deliver the bombs to their targets and drop them. In June, he contacted the U.S. Air Force to identify a combat aircraft that could carry a 17-foot bomb. As a result of this survey, Ramsey writes, it was apparent that the B-29 was the only United States aircraft in which such a bomb could be conveniently carried internally, and even this plane would require considerable modification so that the bomb could extend into both front and rear bomb bays. Except for the British Lancaster, all other aircraft would require such a bomb to be carried externally. The Air Force was not about to allow a historic new weapon of war to be introduced to the world in a British aircraft. But the B-29 Superfortress was a new design, still plagued with serious problems. The first service test model had not yet flown when Ramsey began his aircraft survey in June. A flight test model had crashed into a Seattle packing house in February and killed the plane's entire test crew and 19 packing house workers. Ramsey did not have to wait for access to a B-29 to begin collecting data on the long bomb's ballistics, however. He mocked up a scale model and arranged to see it dropped. On August 13, 1943, the first drop tests of a prototype atomic bomb were made at the Dahlgren Naval Proving Ground by a Navy TBF aircraft to determine stability in flight. These tests were on a 14/23 scale model of a bomb shape, which was then thought probably suitable for a gun assembly. Essentially, the model consisted of a long length of 14-inch pipe welded into the middle of a split standard 500-pound bomb. It was officially known at Dahlgren as the sewer pipe bomb. The first test was an ominous and spectacular failure. The bomb fell in a flat spin such as had rarely been seen before. However, an increase in fin area and a forward movement of the center of gravity provided stability in subsequent tests. In the meantime, Seth Neddermeyer, whose implosion experimentation group Parsons inherited, had visited a U.S. Bureau of Mines laboratory at Brewston, Pennsylvania, to experiment with high explosives. Edwin McMillan, who was interested in implosion, went with the Caltech physicist. At that point, it was just Seth and myself with a few helpers. The first cylindrical implosions were done at Brewston. You take a piece of iron pipe, wrap the explosives around it, and ignite it at several points so that you get a converging wave and squash the cylinder in. That was the birth of the experimental work on implosion, long before experimental work on the gun method. Back at Los Alamos, Neddermeyer set up a small research station on South Mesa, the next mesa south of the hill across Los Alamos Canyon. He fired his first tests in an arroyo on Independence Day 1943, using iron pipe set in cans packed with TNT. Experimenting with cylinders rather than spheres simplified calculation. Because he wanted to recover the results, he packed only limited amounts of explosive. Those tests, of course, could not be very sophisticated, says McMillan. They did show that you could take metal pipes and close them right in so they became like solid bars, indicating that this was a practical method. They also showed that the squeeze was far from uniform. The pipes emerged from the arroyo dust twisted and deformed. When Parsons, a thoroughly pragmatic engineer, had time to look over Neddermeyer's work, he was openly contemptuous. He doubted if implosion could ever be made reliable enough for field use. Neddermeyer presented his initial results at one of the weekly colloquia Oppenheimer had instituted, at Hans Bethe's suggestion, to keep everyone with a white badge, everyone cleared for secrets, informed of tech area progress. Richard P. Feynman, a brilliant, outspoken New York-born graduate student theoretician from Princeton, summarized the opinion of the assembly in a phrase, "It stinks." In the name of lightheartedness, Parsons was crueler. "With everyone grinding away in such dead earnest here," he told the group, "we need a touch of relief. I question Dr. Neddermeyer's seriousness. To my mind, he is gradually working up to what I shall refer to as the beer can experiment. As soon as he gets his explosives properly organized, we will see this done. The point to watch for is whether he can blow in a beer can without splattering the beer. Implosion was even harder to do than that. John von Neumann, the Hungarian mathematician who had come to the United States in 1930 and joined the Institute for Advanced Study, had been examining for the NDRC the complex hydrodynamics of shock waves formed by shaped charges, technology which was being applied to the American tank-killing infantry weapon known as the bazooka. Like Rabi, von Neumann had agreed to serve as an occasional Oppenheimer consultant. He visited Los Alamos at the end of the summer and looked into implosion theory, another warren of hydrodynamic complexity. Neddermeyer had devised a simple theory that worked up to a certain level of violence in the shockwave. Von Neumann, he says, is generally credited with originating the science of large compressions. But I knew it before and had done it in a naive way. Von Neumann's was more sophisticated. Johnny was quite interested in high explosives, Edward Teller remembers. Teller and von Neumann renewed their youthful acquaintance during the mathematician's visit to the Hill. In my discussions with him, some crude calculations were made, Teller continues. The calculation is indeed simple, as long as you assume that the material to be accelerated is incompressible, which is the usual assumption about solid matter. In materials driven by high explosives, pressures of more than 100,000 atmospheres occur. Von Neumann knew that, Teller says, as he did not. On the other hand, if a shell moves in one-third of the way toward the center, you obtain, under the assumption of an incompressible material, a pressure in excess of 8 million atmospheres. This is more than the pressure in the center of the Earth, and it was known to me, but not to Johnny, that at these pressures, iron is not incompressible. In fact, I had rough figures for the relevant compressibilities. The result of all this was that in the implosion, significant compressions will occur, a point which had not been previously discussed. It had been clear from the beginning that implosion, by squeezing a hollow shell of plutonium to a solid ball, could effectively assemble it as a critical mass much faster than the fastest gun could fire. What von Neumann and Teller now realized and communicated to Oppenheimer in October 1943 was that implosion, at more violent compressions than Neddermeyer had yet attempted, should squeeze plutonium to such unearthly densities that a solid subcritical mass could serve as a bomb core, avoiding the complex problem of compressing hollow shells. Nor would pre-detonation threaten from light element impurities. Develop implosion, in other words, and they could deliver a more reliable bomb more quickly. It was possible at that point to estimate roughly the size and shape of a bomb that worked by fast implosion. The big gun bomb would be just under 2 feet in diameter and 17 feet long. An implosion bomb, a thick shell of high explosives surrounding a thick shell of tamper, surrounding a plutonium core, surrounding an initiator, would be just under 5 feet in diameter and a little over 9 feet long. A man-sized egg with tail fins. Norman Ramsey started planning full-scale drop tests that autumn as the aspens brightened to yellow at Los Alamos. He offered to practice with a Lancaster. The Air Force insisted he practice with a B-29, even though the new polished aluminum intercontinental bombers were just beginning production and still scarce. In order that the aircraft modifications could begin, Ramsey writes in his third-person report on this work, Parsons and Ramsey selected two external shapes and weights as representative of the current plans at Site Y. For security reasons, these were called by the Air Force representatives the Thin Man and the Fat Man, respectively. The Air Force officers tried to make their phone conversation sound as though they were modifying a plane to carry Roosevelt, the Thin Man, and Churchill, the Fat Man. Modification of the first B-29 officially began November 29th, 1943. A captain of the Danish Army, who was also a member of the Danish Underground, visited Niels Bohr at the House of Honor in Copenhagen early in 1943. After tea, the two men retired to Bohr's greenhouse, where hidden microphones might not overhear their conversation. The British had instructed the Underground that they would soon be sending Bohr a set of keys. Blind holes had been drilled into the bows of two of the keys, identical micro-dots implanted, and the holes sealed. A captioned diagram located the holes. Professor Bohr should gently file the keys at the point indicated until the hole appears, the document explained. The messages can then be syringed or floated out onto a micro-slide. The captain offered to extract the micro-dot and have it enlarged. Bohr was no secret agent. He accepted the offer, gratefully. When the message arrived, it proved to be a letter from James Chadwick. The letter contained an invitation to my father to go to England, where he would find a very warm welcome, Og Bohr remembers. Chadwick told my father that he would be able to work freely on scientific matters, but it was also mentioned that there were special problems in which his cooperation would be of considerable help. Bohr understood that Chadwick might be hinting about work on nuclear fission. The Danish physicist was still skeptical of its application. He would not stay in Denmark, he wrote Chadwick in return, if I felt I could be of real help. But I do not think that this is probable. Above all, I have, to the best of my judgment, convinced myself that, in spite of all future prospects, any immediate use of the latest marvelous discoveries of atomic physics is impracticable. If an atomic bomb were a serious possibility, Bohr would leave. Otherwise, he had compelling reasons to stay, to help resist the threat against the freedom of our institutions, and to assist in the protection of the exiled scientists who have sought refuge here. The threat against Danish institutions that Bohr was helping to resist was peculiar to the German occupation of Denmark. Germany relied heavily on Danish agriculture, which supplied meat and butter rations to 3.6 million Germans in 1942 alone. It was a labor-intensive agriculture of small farms, and it could only continue with the cooperation of the farmers and, more broadly, of the entire Danish population. Not to arouse resistance, the Nazis had allowed Denmark to keep its constitutional monarchy and continue to govern itself. The Danes, in turn, had extracted an extraordinary price for agreeing to cooperate under foreign occupation: the security of Danish Jews. To the Danes, the 8,000 Jews in Denmark, 95% of them in Copenhagen, were Danish citizens first of all. Their security was therefore a test of German good faith. Danish statesmen and heads of government, reports an historian, one after the other, had made the security of the Jews a conditio sine qua non for the maintenance of a constitutional Danish government. But resistance, especially strikes and sabotage, gradually increased as the Danish people felt the occupation's burden and as the tides of war began to turn against the Axis powers. The German surrender at Stalingrad on February 2, 1943, may have appeared to many Danes to be a turning point. Mussolini's resignation and arrest the following summer on July 25th and the impending surrender of Italy certainly did. On August 28th, the Nazi plenipotentiary for Denmark, Dr. Karl Rudolf Werner Best, presented the Danish government with an ultimatum at Hitler's orders, demanding that it declare a state of national emergency, forbid strikes and meetings, and introduce a curfew, a ban on arms, press censorship at German hands, and the death penalty for harboring arms and for sabotage. With the king's permission, the government refused. On August 29th, the Nazis reoccupied Copenhagen, disarmed the Danish army, blockaded the royal palace, and confined the king. One reason for the takeover was Nazi determination to eliminate the Danish Jews, whose exemption from the final solution infuriated Hitler. The Nazis had arrested several Jewish notables on August 29th. They planned to arrest Bohr, but had decided the deed would be less obvious during a general roundup. In early September, Bohr learned from the Swedish ambassador in Copenhagen that his emigre colleagues, including his collaborator Stefan Rosenthal, were slated for arrest. He contacted the underground, which helped the émigrés escape across the Öresund to Sweden. Rosenthal endured 9 stormy hours crowded with other refugees in a rowboat borrowed from a city park before his exhausted party made Swedish landfall. Bohr's turn came soon after. The Swedish ambassador took tea at the House of Honor on September 28th and hinted that Bohr would be arrested within a few days. Even professors were leaving Denmark, Margarete Bohr remembers the diplomat emphasizing. The next morning, word came through her brother-in-law that an anti-Nazi German woman working at Gestapo offices in Copenhagen had seen orders authorized in Berlin for the arrest and deportation of Niels and Harald Bohr. "We had to get away the same day," Margarete Bohr said afterward, "and the boys would have to follow later. But many were helping. Friends arranged for a boat, and we were told we could take one small bag." In the late afternoon of September 29th, the Bohrs walked through Copenhagen to a seaside suburban garden and hid in a gardener's shed. They waited for night. At a prearranged time, they left the shed and crossed to the beach. A motorboat ran them out to a fishing boat. Threading minefields and German patrols, they crossed the Øresund by moonlight and landed at Lindholm, near Malmö. Bohr had learned at the last minute that the Nazis planned to round up all the Danish Jews the next evening and deport them to Germany. Leaving his wife in southern Sweden to await the crossing of their sons, he rushed to Stockholm to appeal to the Swedish government for aid. He discovered that the Swedes had offered to intern the Danish Jews, but the Germans had denied that any roundup was planned. In fact, it proceeded on schedule, while Bohr worked his way through the Swedish bureaucracy, but fell far short of success. The Danes, warned in advance, had spontaneously hidden their Jewish fellow citizens away. Only some 284 elderly rest home residents had been seized. The more than 7,000 Jews remaining in Denmark were temporarily safe. But few of them planned at first to leave the country. It was far from certain that Sweden would accept them, and there seemed nowhere else to go. Meeting with the Swedish Undersecretary for Foreign Affairs on September 30th, Bohr had urged that Sweden make public its protest note to the German Foreign Office. He saw that publicity would alert the potential victims, signal Swedish sympathy, and bring pressure to bear on the Nazis to desist. The Undersecretary told him Sweden planned no further intervention beyond the confidential note. Bohr appealed to the Foreign Minister on October 2nd, failed to win publication of the note, and determined to dispense with intermediaries. Rosenthal says the Danish laureate went to see Princess Ingeborg, the sister of the Danish King Christian X, and while there, expressed the desire to be received by the King of Sweden. Bohr also contacted the Danish ambassador and influential Swedish academic colleagues. Rosenthal describes the crucial meeting with the king. The audience took place that afternoon. King Gustav said that the Swedish government had tried a similar approach to the Germans once before, when the occupying power had started deporting Jews from Norway. The approach, however, had been rejected. Bohr objected that in the meantime the situation had changed decisively by reason of the Allied victories, and he suggested that the offer by the Swedish government to assume responsibility for the Danish Jews should be made public. The king promised to talk to the foreign minister at once, but he emphasized the great difficulties of putting the plan into operation. The difficulties were overcome. Swedish radio broadcast the Swedish protest that evening, October 2nd, and reported the country ready to offer asylum. The broadcast signaled a route of escape. In the next 2 months, 7,220 Jews crossed to safety in Sweden with the active help of the Swedish Coast Guard. One refugee's report of what first alerted him in hiding to the idea of escape is typical. "At the pastor's house, I heard on the Swedish radio that the Bohr brothers had fled to Sweden by boat and that the Danish Jews were being cordially received." With personal intervention on behalf of the principle of openness, which exposes crime as well as error to public view, Niels Bohr played a decisive part in the rescue of the Danish Jews. Stockholm was alive with German agents, and there was fear that Bohr would be assassinated. "The stay in Stockholm lasted only a short time," remembers Aga Bohr. A telegram was received from Lord Cherwell with an invitation to come to England. My father immediately accepted and requested that I should be permitted to accompany him. Aga was 21 at the time and a promising young physicist. It was not possible for the rest of the family to follow. My mother and brothers stayed in Sweden. Bohr went first. The British flew their diplomatic pouch back and forth from Stockholm in an unarmed two-engine Mosquito bomber, a light, fast aircraft that could fly high enough to avoid the German anti-aircraft batteries on the west coast of Norway. Flak usually topped out at 20,000 feet. The Mosquito's bomb bay was fitted for a single passenger. On October 6th, Bohr donned a flight suit and strapped on a parachute. The pilot supplied him with a flight helmet with built-in earphones for communication with the cockpit and showed him the location of his oxygen hookup. Bohr also took delivery of a stick of flares. In case of attack, the pilot would dump the bomb bay and Bohr would parachute into the cold North Sea. The flares would aid his rescue if he survived. "The Royal Air Force was not used to such great heads as Bohr's," says Robert Oppenheimer wryly. Aga Bohr describes the near disaster. The Mosquito flew at a great height, and it was necessary to use oxygen masks. The pilot gave word on the intercom when the supply of oxygen should be turned on. But as the helmet with the earphones did not fit my father's head, he did not hear the order and soon fainted because of lack of oxygen. The pilot realized that something was wrong when he received no answer to his inquiries, and as soon as they had passed over Norway, he came down and flew low over the North Sea. When the plane landed in Scotland, my father was conscious again. The vigorous 58-year-old was none the worse for wear. "Once in England and recovered," Oppenheimer continues the story, "he learned from Chadwick what had been going on. Aga arrived a week later, and father and son toured Britain, observing the developing activities there of the Tube Alloys project, which included a section of a pilot-scale gaseous diffusion plant. But the center of gravity had long since shifted to the United States. The British were preparing to recover a share of the initiative by sending a mission to Los Alamos to help design the bombs. They wanted Bohr on their team to increase its influence and prestige. By then, the Danish theoretician had taken what Oppenheimer calls a good first look at how nuclear weapons would change the world, Oppenheimer means. He emphasizes Bohr's developing understanding then with a potent simile. It came to him as a revelation. Very much as when he learned of Rutherford's discovery of the nucleus 30 years before. So Niels Bohr prepared in the early winter of 1943 to travel to America once again with an important and original revelation in hand, this one in the realm not of physics, but of the political organization of the world. He was willing to be impressed by a mighty progress of industry. The work on atomic energy in the USA and in England proved to have advanced much further than my father had expected, Aga Bohr understates. Robert Oppenheimer pitches his summary closer to the shock of surprise a refugee released from the suspended animation that had been occupied Denmark would have felt. To Bohr, the enterprises in the United States seemed completely fantastic. They were. 15. Different Animals. The 59,000 acres of Appalachian semi-wilderness along the Clinch River in eastern Tennessee, the Brigadier General Leslie R. Groves acquired for the Manhattan Engineer District as one of his first official acts in September 1942, extended from the Cumberland foothills in a series of parallel southwestern running ridge valleys. Groves liked the geology, which offered isolation for his several enterprises. But the new reservation was nearly as primitive as Los Alamos would be. The Clinch, a meandering tributary of the Tennessee, defined the reservation's southeastern and southwestern boundaries. Eastward 20 miles was Knoxville, a city of 112,000. Farther east, the wall of Great Smoky Mountains National Park. 5 unpaved county roads traversed the 92 square miles of depleted valleys and scrub oak ridges, an area 17 miles long and 7 miles wide that supported only about 1,000 families in rural poverty. In the ridge-barricaded valleys of this impoverished hill country, far from prying eyes, The United States Army intended to construct the futuristic factories that would separate U-235 from U-238 in quantity sufficient to make an atomic bomb. To do so, it had first to improve communications and build a town. Into the gummy, red eastern Tennessee clay in the winter of 1942 and the spring of 1943, its contractors cut 55 miles of railroad bed and 300 miles of paved roads and streets. They improved the important county roads to four-lane highways. Stone and Webster, the hard-pressed Boston Engineering Corporation, laid out a town plan so unimaginative that the MED rejected it and passed the assignment to the ambitious young architectural firm of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, which produced a well-sited arrangement of housing using innovative new materials that saved enough money to allow for such amenities in the best residences as fireplaces and porches. The new town, planned initially for 13,000 workers, took its name from its location, lining a long section of the northwesternmost valley, Oak Ridge. The entire reservation, fenced with barbed wire and controlled through seven guarded gates, was named, after a nearby Tennessee community, the Clinton Engineer Works. Its workers would come to call it Dog Patch in homage to the hillbilly comic strip Lil Abner. The new gates closed off public access on April 1st. Groves planned to build electromagnetic isotope separation plants and a gaseous diffusion plant at Clinton. Plutonium production, he realized during his first months on the project, would proceed at such a scale and generate so vast a quantity of potentially dangerous radioactivity that it would require a separate reservation of its own. Of the three processes, Ernest Lawrence's electromagnetic method was farthest along. Electromagnetic isotope separation enlarged and elaborated Francis Aston's 1918 Cavendish invention, the mass spectrograph. As a 1945 report prepared by Lawrence's staff explains, the method depends on the fact that an electrically charged atom traveling through a magnetic field moves in a circle whose radius is determined by its mass, which was also a basic principle of Lawrence's cyclotron. The lighter the atom, the tighter the circle it made. Form ions of a vaporous uranium compound and start them moving at one side of a vacuum tank permeated by a strong magnetic field, and the moving ions as they curved around would separate into two beams. Lighter U-235 atoms would follow a narrower arc than heavier U-238 atoms. Across a 4-foot semicircle, the separation might be about 0.3 inches. Set a collecting pocket at the point where the U-235 ion beam separately arrived and you could catch the ions. When the ions strike the bottom of the collecting pocket, they give up their charge and are deposited as flakes of metal. The arrangement had slotted electrodes to accelerate the ions. Late in 1941, Lawrence had installed such a 180-degree mass spectrometer in place of the Ds in the Berkeley 37-inch cyclotron. By running it continuously for a month, his crews produced a partially separated 100-microgram sample of U-235. That was several hundred million times less than the 100 kilograms Robert Oppenheimer had originally estimated would be necessary to make a bomb. The demonstration proved the basic principles of electromagnetic separation, even as it dramatized the method's monumental prodigality. Lawrence was proposing to separate uranium atom by individual atom. Enlarging the equipment, increasing the accelerating voltage, multiplying the number of sources and collectors set side by side between the poles of the same magnet were obvious ways to improve output and efficiency. Lawrence had committed his time to winning the war. Now he committed his beautiful new 184-inch cyclotron. Instead of cyclotron Ds, he had D-shaped mass spectrometer tanks installed between the pole faces of its 4,500-ton magnet. Making the new instrument work through the spring and summer of 1942, solved the most difficult design problems. It acquired a name along the way, Calutron, another Tron from the University of California. To separate 100 grams, about 4 ounces, of U-235 per day, Lawrence estimated in the autumn of 1942 would require some 2,000 4-foot cauldron tanks set among thousands of tons of magnets. If a bomb needed 30 kilograms, 66 pounds, of U-235 for reasonable efficiency, as the Berkeley Summer Study Group had just worked out, 2,000 such calutrons could enrich material enough for one bomb core every 300 days. That assumed the system worked reliably, which so far its laboratory predecessors had hardly done. Yet in 1942, electromagnetic separation still looked so much more promising to James Bryan Conant than either the plutonium approach or gaseous barrier diffusion that he had offered up for debate the possibility of pursuing it exclusively. Lawrence was self-confident, but not foolhardy. He insisted that the two dark horses should continue to run the race alongside the favorite. Groves was less impressed. So was the first Lewis committee that had visited Chicago and Berkeley when Fermi was building CP1 in the winter of 1942. The Lewis committee judged gaseous diffusion the best approach because it was most like existing technology. Diffusion was a phenomenon familiar to petroleum engineers, and a gaseous diffusion plant would be essentially an enormous interconnected assemblage of pipes and pumps. Electromagnetic separation, by contrast, was a batch process, untested at such monumental scale. Berkeley planned a system of 4-foot tanks set vertically between the pole faces of large square electromagnets, 2 tanks to a gap, and a total of 96 tanks per unit. To reduce the amount of iron needed for the magnet cores, the arrangement would not be rectangular, but oval, like a racetrack. And racetrack it was called, though its official designation was Alpha. Berkeley could promise only 5 grams of enriched uranium per day per racetrack. But Groves thought 2,000 tanks well beyond Stone and Webster's capability and cut the number back to 500. Reasoning, as Lawrence recalled later, that the art and science of the process would go forward, and that by the time the plant was built, substantially higher production rates would be assured. 5 grams per day per racetrack, with only 5 racetracks, would mean 1,200 days per 30-kilogram bomb, even if the Alpha Calutrons produced nearly pure U-235, which they did not. Their best production was around 15%. Groves counted on improvements and forged ahead. He had to begin building before he knew precisely what to build. He worked from the general to the particular, from outline to detail. Fully 6 months before he decided how many calutrons to authorize, his predecessors, Colonel James Marshall and Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Nichols, had moved to solve one serious problem of supply. The United States was critically short of copper, the best common metal for winding the coils of electromagnets. For recoverable use, the Treasury offered to make silver bullion available in copper's stead. The Manhattan District put the offer to the test, Nichols negotiating the loan with Treasury Undersecretary Daniel Bell. At one point in the negotiations, writes Groves, Nichols said that they would need between 5,000 and 10,000 tons of silver. This led to the icy reply, Colonel, in the Treasury we do not speak of tons of silver. Our unit is the troy ounce. Eventually, 395 million troy ounces of silver, 13,540 short tons, went off from the West Point Depository to be cast into cylindrical billets, rolled into 40-foot strips, and wound onto iron cores at Alice Chalmers in Milwaukee. Solid silver bus bars a square foot in cross-section crowned each racetrack's long oval. The silver was worth more than $300 million. Groves accounted for it ounce by ounce, almost as carefully as he accounted for the fissionable isotope it helped separate. Stone and Webster had only foundation drawings in hand when its contractors broke ground for the first Alpha racetrack building on February 18, 1943. Groves had initially approved three buildings to house five racetracks. In March, he authorized a second, beta stage of half-size Calutrons, 72 tanks on two rectangular tracks that would further enrich the eventual Alpha output to 90% U-235. Alpha and Beta buildings alone eventually covered more area in the valley between Pine and Chestnut Ridges than would 20 football fields. Racetracks were mounted on second floors. First floors held monumental pumps to exhaust the Calutrons to high vacuum, more cubic feet of vacuum than the combined total volume pumped down everywhere else on Earth at that time. Eventually, the Y-12 complex counted 268 permanent buildings, large and small. The Calutron structures of steel and brick and tile, chemistry laboratories, a distilled water plant, sewage treatment plants, pump houses, a shop, a service station, warehouses, cafeterias, gatehouses, change houses and locker rooms, a paymaster's office, a foundry, a generator building, 8 electric substations, 19 water cooling towers, for an output measured in the best of times in grams per day. An inspection trip in May 1943 awed even Ernest Lawrence. By August, 20,000 construction workers swarmed over the area. An experimental Alpha unit saw successful operation. Lawrence was urging Groves then to double the Alpha plant. With 10 Alpha racetracks instead of 5, he estimated he could separate half a kilogram of U-235 per day at 85% enrichment. An Army engineer's less exuberant summary, written 6 days after Lawrence's, predicted 900 grams per month, with existing Alpha and Beta stages beginning in November 1943, for a total of 22 kilograms of bomb-grade U-235 in the first year of operation. Faced with new estimates from Los Alamos that summer that an efficient uranium gun would probably require 40 kilograms, 88 pounds, of the rarer uranium isotope, Groves bought Lawrence's proposal. The doubling would add 4 new 96-tank tracks of advanced design, designated Alpha 2, and a proportionate number of Beta tracks, at a cost of $150 million more than the $100 million already authorized. If everything worked at Y-12, Groves justified his proposal to the Military Policy Committee, he would then have a 40-kilogram bomb core around the beginning of 1945. The Army had contracted with Tennessee Eastman, a manufacturing subsidiary of Eastman Kodak, to operate the electromagnetic separation plant. By late October 1943, when Stone and Webster finished installing the first Alpha racetrack, the company had assembled a workforce of 4,800 men and women. They were trained to run and maintain the Calutrons, without knowing why, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The big square racetrack magnets, wrapped with silver windings, were encased in boxes of welded steel. Oil that circulated through the boxes was supposed to insulate the windings and carry the heat away. The first magnets tested at the end of October leaked electricity. If moisture in the circulating oil was shorting out the coils, the normal heat of operation would correct the problem by evaporating the water. Tennessee Eastman pushed on. Vacuum leaks in the Calutron tanks were numerous and hard to find. One supervisor remembers spending most of a month looking for one leak. Inexperienced operators had trouble striking and maintaining a steady ion beam. Groves recalls that the powerful magnets unexpectedly moved the intervening tanks, which weighed some 14 tons each, out of position by as much as 3 inches. The problem was solved by securely welding the tanks into place using heavy steel tie straps. Once that was done, the tanks stayed where they belonged. The magnets dried out but continued to short. Something was seriously wrong. Early in December, Tennessee Eastman shut the entire 96-tank racetrack down. The company's engineers would have to break open one of the windings and examine it. That was major trauma. The unit must then be returned to Alice Chalmers and rebuilt. The inspectors found disaster. Two major troubles. The first lay in the design, writes Groves, which placed the heavy current-carrying silver bands too close together. The other lay in the excessive amount of rust and other dirt particles in the circulating oil. These bridged the too narrow gap between the silver bands and resulted in shorting. Groves arrived seething from Washington on December 15th to view the remains. The design's inadequacy forced the general to order all 48 magnets hauled back to Milwaukee to be cleaned and rebuilt. The second Alpha track would not come online until mid-January 1944. They would lose at least a month of production. Tennessee Eastman's 4,800 employees reported for work in the shambles of gloomy halls. Rather than lose them from boredom, the company scheduled classes, conferences, lectures, motion pictures, games. Serious men in double-breasted suits scouted the state for chess and checker sets. At the end of 1943, Y-12 was dead in the water, with hardly a gram of U-235 to show for all its enormous expense. Gaseous diffusion research had progressed at Columbia University since John Dunning and Eugene Booth had first demonstrated measurable U-235 separation in November 1941. By the spring of 1942, Harold Urey could note in a progress report that three methods for the separation of the uranium isotope have now reached the engineering stage. They are the English and the American diffusion methods and the centrifuge method. With the authorization of the full-scale plant, Dunning's staff, which had grown to include about 90 people, increased in early 1943 to 225. Franz Simon's diffusion method would have operated at low gas pressures and in incremental 10-unit stages, but required extremely large pumps. Columbia designed a high-pressure system with more conventional pumps, a continuous interconnected cascade of some 4,000 stages. In a post-war memoir, Groves reviews the design, which was both reliably simple and expensively tedious. The method was completely novel. It was based on the theory that if uranium gas was pumped against a porous barrier, the lighter molecules of the gas, containing U-235, would pass through more rapidly than the heavier U-238 molecules. The heart of the process was, therefore, the barrier, a porous, thin metal sheet or membrane with millions of submicroscopic openings per square inch. These sheets were formed into tubes, which were enclosed in an airtight vessel, the diffuser. As the gas, uranium hexafluoride, was pumped through a long series, or cascade, of these tubes, it tended to separate, the enriched gas moving up the cascade while the depleted moved down. However, there is so little difference in mass between the hexafluoride of U-238 and U-235 that it was impossible to gain much separation in a single diffusion step. That was why there had to be several thousand successive stages. Further development of barriers is needed, Urey had concluded in his progress report. But we now feel confident that the problem can be solved. It had not been solved when Groves committed the Manhattan Project to a $100 million gaseous diffusion plant, however. No practical barrier was yet in hand. The American process required finer poured material than the British. The material also had to be rugged enough to withstand the higher pressure.